Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. In the year 460 BC, Hippocrates recognized what we now call migraines when he described a shining light that was typically seen in one eye, followed by severe pain that started in the temples and worked its way over the head and down into the neck. Today, up to 10% of us suffer migraines, yet many have not sought professional help, presumably thinking there's little to offer. Our phone numbers are 550-8422 in Anchorage. Outside of Anchorage, toll-free 1-800-478-8255. And our email address, line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll answer your questions and concerns about migraines and other headaches on Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by The Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome to Line 1 again. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're going to be discussing migraine headaches. We may get into chronic daily headache and some other headaches depending on your phone calls. So our phone numbers are familiar to you if you listen to APRN Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, those numbers are 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, and you can email us at line1, spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. Today, my guest is Mayo Clinic Scottsdale neurologist and headache researcher, Dr. David Dodick. He is also president-elect of the American Headache Society. Before we get started, I want to mention next week's guest will be Marshall Miller and Melissa Lopez, and we'll be discussing the questions that college students are asking about human sexuality. Dr. Dodick, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about headaches, and I guess one of the first things that I always ask is, or think about, is I remember being told that there's really no pain fibers, or the brain doesn't itself respond with pain. So is that true, and if so, where's the headache coming from?
Well, great question. I mean, it is true that if you actually cut the brain, it won't hurt because the brain itself has no pain fibers. But the brain is surrounded by a capsule that we call dura, and that's one of the most heavily innervated structures in the body with pain fibers. It's a sort of a, you can think of it as a protective skin over the brain. And we think that it's in those nerve endings that the pain of migraine originates. You can think of it biologically as we've evolved to have this sort of protective capsule over the brain because we're protecting really the most important organ in our body. So I believe it's in those little pain nerve endings that innervate or supply that capsule as well as the blood vessels in that capsule and around the brain that actually generate the pain of migraine.
So the idea not too long ago was that that migraine was really a vascular phenomenon, and it was changes in the blood flow, perhaps through the meninges, that led to that pain. And I recently read your article in Scientific American about migraine, and it seemed like that theory doesn't seem to hold water as much anymore.
No. And actually, what we believe happens is that whether or not a patient has an aura, which is a reversible neurological symptoms often manifested as a visual illusion, or whether they don't have aura, we believe that migraine begins in the brain. Now, it's controversial to some extent where in the brain it begins, but a lot of patients, even who don't have aura, have other symptoms before the attack begins, or the pain begins, such as yawning, or they pass more urine, or they get thirsty, or very tired, or they have a mood change. So these symptoms really begin in the brain, and that means that migraine begins in the brain. Now, the downstream effect of that activity that's going on in the brain may have an effect downstream on the blood vessels that surround the brain. Mm-hmm. So there may be changes in blood flow or in the tone or caliber, if you will, or distension of the blood vessels, but that's an epi or a downstream phenomenon of what's actually happening in the brain. So right now we consider migraine to be a largely inherited neurological disorder of the brain where the vascular changes are primarily secondary.
Okay. I want to really focus on migraine, but before we get there, and maybe kind of out of context, so many patients often worry about headache as a cause of something much more severe, such as a tumor or perhaps an aneurysm. So just to get this off the table a little bit, what are the hints from a patient standpoint and a physician standpoint of things that really are crying out that we need to not miss this and particularly get into the imaging studies that are in so much demand for headache?
Yeah, great question. Well, the most important thing is that if you're not one who normally suffers from headache, if you have a headache that begins rather suddenly, in other words, right now I have no headache, and in another second I have a headache that's really severe, so it's a split-second onset, that's a headache you always need to be concerned about. That's a headache that's actually, we consider it a medical emergency. You have to get yourself to see a physician urgently, and that usually requires scanning, because we worry in those instances about a ruptured aneurysm or a blood clot in one of the vessels in the brain and the like. So that's really important, the suddenness with which the headache begins. And even if you are a headache sufferer, if you have a headache that's uncharacteristically sudden and severe, that you really need to worry about. Mm-hmm. When you have a headache that's associated with systemic symptoms like fever or chills or weight loss or malaise, that's a headache you need to be concerned about, and you probably need to see your physician, and imaging studies are likely have to be done. If you yourself have a history of cancer, let's say breast cancer or lung cancer or colon cancer, even if it's in the remote past and you start developing headaches, you need to be concerned about that. If you're older, and every year I push what I mean by older forward, but let's say if you're middle-aged and you're 45 or 50 years of age and you really have never had headaches before and all of a sudden you're starting to experience recurrent headache, you need to be concerned about that. So now I'm 46 years old. I've never really had headaches, but if I started having headaches repeatedly, I'm going to be concerned about that. And then the other thing is that if a headache is progressive and daily, even in those who have experienced headaches, when you have a headache that just never quits and it continues to get worse and worse over time, that's obviously a headache you need to be concerned about. So, you know, the suddenness of the onset, the progressive nature of the headache, any systemic signs or symptoms, and then finally, if you have a neurological symptom, if there's any change in the level of alertness or awareness, confusion, numbness or tingling down one side of the body, weakness down one side of the body, unsteadiness, you really need to be concerned about that. So those, I think, are the hints that a headache may be secondary to something else like a brain tumor or an aneurysm. But let me reassure your audience that 9 times out of 10, when we see a headache in the office or a patient coming in complaining of headaches, that headache is not going to be due to something sinister. It's usually going to be due to migraine. So headache as an isolated symptom is usually not due to some underlying sinister disease.
Okay. All right, so let's now delve into migraine and tell us what's the typical or the most common presentation. Now, you may be biased in the kind of patient you see with migraine compared to myself as a pediatrician or a family practice, but what is the most common presentation or the common symptoms of patients that are suffering with migraine?
So typically, as I said, about 3/4 of patients, they'll have a prodromal or a premonitory phase where they develop symptoms that they may not even recognize initially, but symptoms that signify that the pain is coming. So again, passing more urine, a change in mood, yawning, thirst, craving foods, this sort of thing, or an actual neurological aura, usually the visual illusion that I talked about earlier. Then the pain will usually begin, and when the pain begins, it's often mild. And some people may think that they just have what they call a stress headache or a tension headache or something like this. But the pain will eventually escalate. It may or may take on a throbbing nature. It may or may not be on one side. A lot of people think that a migraine is just a one-sided headache, which, of course, in half the cases, it's not. It may be more severe on one side. It may begin on one side, but eventually it involves both sides of the head. Sometimes there's associated nausea. Sometimes people even vomit. but they don't have to. And sometimes, and usually, they're unusually sensitive to light. And I don't mean bright sunlight, but I mean just the light that's on in the kitchen or, you know, the light that comes off the television. Unusually sensitive to light and noise. The pain is usually aggravated by routine physical activity like walking around or climbing steps or bending or coughing or straining. And sometimes there's other associated symptoms like dizziness, trouble concentrating, and those sorts of things. So that's typical. I say that any bad headache that recurs over time, and I mean bad headache, that's at least what we say on a 10-point scale, at least 5 out of 10, is invariably going to be migraine.
Okay. So I'm going to guess that's an area where patients may be frustrated because physicians may not recognize, may not make the diagnosis, may not then go to the right therapy with what are not the typical one-sided throbbing headaches that make people are associated with vomiting and light sensitivity. You're broadening that thought process for diagnosis for me.
Absolutely, and that is why 50% of patients who even get up the nerve to go into their doctor mm-hmm. because of their headaches, 50% don't receive the right diagnosis. Because even when I was a resident in training, when I first started, I used to carry around this definition in my head that a migraineur had to be this person with a one-sided headache that throbbed where they vomited mm-hmm. and had an aura. And if they didn't have that, well, they didn't have migraine. They had something else. And, of course, that's wrong. So I tell patients it's kind of like asthma. You can have asthma and wheeze a couple of times a year or after exercise, and you can have asthma and be on a ventilator. So you can have migraine attacks that really are kind of mild, and you can have migraine attacks that are more severe. And invariably, people have a spectrum where some of their attacks may be mild, some of their attacks may be moderate, and some may be more severe. And so, therefore, even people who have a diagnosis of migraine often come in saying, well, I have multiple different types of headaches. I have my stress headaches, I have my sinus headaches, and I have my migraine headaches. When, in fact, what they have is migraine headache, mm-hmm. just presenting, you know, in different shades, if you will.
I was going to use the example of asthma because it's a special interest of mine, and one of the things that if you specialize in any particular chronic problem, I think it's probably generally true that across the board we're beginning to recognize there's tremendous variation. And also, there's another analogy in that many people with asthma will start to notice before their attacks, they'll have an itching on their neck or something, very similar to what you mentioned about the prodrome of migraine. Not,
yeah.
not to take that too far, but again, we as physicians are learning that there's a much, much more of a, I guess, a bell-shaped curve with all of our, especially these chronic illnesses, and they're underdiagnosed for that reason.
Exactly. Exactly.
I do have an email, and I think I'm going to jump to this real quickly since the gentleman came and wrote in pretty quickly. He says he suffered from routine cluster migraines from the age of about 12. I'm now just over 60. I didn't treat. I just lived with them, even though they'd run for 3 or 4 days with excruciating pain, vomiting. His mother also got similar had a similar problem. In 2003, after 4 terrible days with migraine, he suffered a stroke. This was days just before the AMA, he says, reported a link between migraines and stroke, which was was reported in a study done in the Netherlands. He's recovered and much of what he's lost during the stroke. I'd like to encourage listeners who get migraines to get them treated and don't brave them out as I did. The risk is not worth it. There are multiple treatments available. Your comments.
Well, there's a lot in that case history.
There is.
The first would be that cluster migraine is an entity, or it's a term that was used a lot through the 70s and 80s and 90s. It's even used by some physicians today, but it's actually not an entity that exists. You either have cluster or you have migraine. Now, you can have cluster that kind of looks like migraine and migraine that sometimes kind of looks like cluster, but you usually have one or the other. Some people have both, but they don't have them the same things during, you know, they don't have cluster and migraine during the same attack.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I mean is that sometimes people with migraine, and this is one of the reasons that sinus headache is one of the most common misdiagnoses, they often have, sometimes have a little tearing,
right.
sometimes have a little fullness in the face or pressure behind the above the eye or below the eye, and therefore they think, well, what's under there? The sinuses.
Right.
So they think they have sinus headache. And so that's one of the reasons why I think some people get labeled with this cluster migraine. So it sounds like your person who emailed you probably has migraine, headed for the better part of 40 years. Mother has migraine as well. And then he's linking it to stroke, which has definitely been shown. There's no question that people with migraine, but only those with aura, it seems, have an increased risk of stroke in the order of 2 to 3-fold. So a migraine sufferer with aura is about 2 to 3 times more likely to have a stroke than an age and sex match control who doesn't have migraine with aura. And there's a complex biology there that might explain it, but there's no question that that's the case. What I want to make sure that your listeners are aware of is that when I say that the risk is 2 to 3-fold, the risk of, let's say, a 40-year-old woman without migraine having a stroke is about 4 in 100,000. So if you took 100,000 women age 40, none of them have migraine and they don't have other vascular risk factors, the likelihood is that 4 of those 100,000 will have a stroke in this year. If now you add migraine with aura to it, will you double or triple the risk? So that sounds like a lot, but we're still talking about something on the order of maybe 10 or 12 or 15 per 100,000. So the absolute risk is really still quite small. Now, when you pile on other risk factors, like high blood pressure, like diabetes, like young women who take the pill, then you substantially increase that risk. Now we might be talking somewhere around 80 or 100 per 100,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, the risk is still small, but it's no longer, you know, sort of negligent or negligible, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there is a risk of stroke in people who have migraines. Sometimes those strokes are asymptomatic or there are no symptoms from it. And sometimes there are symptoms from it and a patient has a full-blown clinical stroke. So what I tell people is, really, if you have migraine with aura, there's no evidence yet that you should take aspirin every day because the risk of bleeding on aspirin is much greater than the risk of having a stroke just because you have migraine. But if you're a young woman, you should really talk to your physician before you start taking the pill, because the pill also increases the risk of blood clots in women with migraine, particularly those with aura. And if you have other risk factors, you should really have those aggressively managed.
Okay, so although the risk of stroke is increased in migraine sufferers, the vast, vast majority of migraine sufferers are not at that much of an increased risk, is what I heard you say.
That's pretty much what I said.
Yeah. What comes to my mind is, what kind of stroke are we talking about is associated? Are both thrombotic and hemorrhagic strokes both increased, or is one specifically associated?
No, they're ischemic strokes.
Okay.
Yep. So migraine, not at an increased risk of hemorrhagic strokes.
Okay. All right. Tell us a little bit more about migraine. Who does it strike? How long do they last? What's the typical natural history, as us physicians talk about, of migraine?
Usually strike in adolescents, often in young girls after they start menstruating. But they peak, and they're certainly 3 times more common in women, likely due to fluctuating estrogen throughout the reproductive life cycle. Increased incidence between the ages of like 15 and 35 or 15 to 40 in women. And then the prevalence of migraine goes down. So it's sort of a bell-shaped curve where young kids around the age of 10, 13 start to experience migraine. It increases and peaks in the 20s and 30s and then goes down in the 40s and 50s thereafter. So that's the sort of bell-shaped curve I talked about, 3 times more common in women. And usually people suffer on average 1 to 2 attacks per month. But, of course, there's a lot of variability there. I have patients who experience migraine every single day of their life, and I have patients with migraine who, you know, really suffer very infrequently, maybe once or twice a year. But average, once to twice a month, average duration is about 24 hours. But, again, there's variability around that. One of the things that we as physicians don't consider a lot is that when we say duration, 24 hours, we're talking about the duration of pain. And I'm on a crusade now to take the headache out of migraine, because migraine is so much more than just a headache, right? It really minimizes and trivializes the condition by saying it's just a headache, because these patients are profoundly disabled sometimes during their attacks. They're nauseated. They're vomiting. They can't speak properly. They can't understand what people are saying. They have no ability to concentrate whatsoever. They sometimes can't remember very well what's happening during an attack. They may or may not have neurological symptoms. So they're profoundly impaired. And some of those symptoms outlast the pain itself. So when I say that the usual duration is 24 hours, the actual duration of an attack from beginning when the prodromal symptoms hit to the end when the postdromal symptoms are over may be much longer than 24 hours. So I think we do patients a disservice by just measuring the duration of pain.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment that migraines far, far more than just a headache. And I think your article in the New England Journal also discusses that there's now some very good various ways to look at what's going on in the brain that produces or is associated at least with aura demonstrate that it's really maybe a brainstem and a cortical disease all at the same time, or disorder, I should say.
Exactly. I mean, there's some very abnormal activity going on in the brain. I will show a patient sometimes. I say, this is your brain. This is your brain with migraine. Mm-hmm. And I'll show them a PET scan or a functional MRI, and the two look quite different. So patients immediately see that, okay, there's something seriously going on in the brain here. There's abnormal patterns of activity in certain regions of the brain. So it's much more than just a headache.
And the same thing can be said, as I assume, between the difference in what's going on in the brain that we now know with these functional studies of the brain with migraine as opposed to, let's say, cluster headache, which you've mentioned already, or stress headache and so forth, so other causes, or even a brain tumor headache. So it's a distinctly different process that's going on.
Absolutely, absolutely. Very specific areas in the brain are activated during a migraine attack, which accounts for the symptoms that we see. And those activation, those areas in the brain that are activated, they're different depending on what type of headache you have.
Let me mention our phone numbers for those of you who are listening who would like to ask a question today about migraines, 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. You mentioned estrogen and its its association with migraines, perhaps based on the age spread and the fact that women have more common are associated with migraines much more commonly. Do you want to talk about women, migraines associated with periods something to do with it, what is a trigger, a triggering mechanism, and what that may be telling us about this disorder?
Yeah, so the reason that migraine is probably three times more common in women, if I said it's a genetic disorder largely, then obviously men are going to have it as well, and 6% of the male population out there has migraine. But the reason it's more common in women is likely because of the triggering influence of estrogen. Estrogen has a profound effect on pain pathways in the brain and in other areas of the brain that are critical for the generation of migraine. So there are estrogen receptors, as you know, but as your audience may not know, all throughout the brain. And what the brain doesn't like is variability, right? So when estrogen levels plummet before menstruation, well, the brain reacts to that. And if you are a migraineur, then the brain is going to react with a migraine attack. So it's that peaks and valleys that the brain doesn't like. That's why migraine prevalence decreases in women as they go through menopause, usually, and are equal to that of men after the age of 55. And that is why as many boys as girls suffer from migraine before those girls start to menstruate, because estrogen levels are at a steady state or at a steady level. It's also why usually in women who are pregnant, migraine gets better, particularly when estrogen levels, because they peak, but they stay high. So, again, the brain likes steady. You can either be steady high or steady low, but you can't have these peaks and valleys. And that's where migraineurs usually start to experience their attacks. And that's why between the ages of 15 and 40, we see this peak in the prevalence of migraine.
Mm-hmm. You know, not to belittle this, but why would men then have any migraine? Is there estrogens in men? Are there differences in their receptors? Is that been looked at in any way?
Well, because, again, this is a genetic disorder that makes certain areas in the brain vulnerable to responding to a variety of triggers, then, of course, men are going to have it. Estrogen is only one trigger. And that is why, you know, some women go out and they have a hysterectomy or they have their ovaries taken out, right? Or they go on hormone replacement to try to even out their estrogen levels so that they don't fluctuate. But there again, that's not a cure because there are many other triggers for migraine.
Okay.
Estrogen fluctuation being just one of them. There are women, for example, where estrogen fluctuation has no effect on their migraine headaches. So I kind of liken it to like matches in a box where estrogen is just one match. There are many ways to light the fire if the fire is migraine. And if you take estrogen out of the box, well, I've got other matches where I can light that fire.
Okay, gotcha.
So a man has matches in the box, too. Estrogen doesn't happen to be one of them, but he certainly has matches in the box.
All right, I think I'm going to take our mid-course break here. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. In Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. Our email address is line1@aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails and discuss migraine headaches with Dr. David Dodick. You are on Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, your health connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. And by Providence Imaging Center, offering mammogram parties created in a private and personal setting designed for patient support with annual and baseline mammograms. Information at provimaging.com.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're speaking with Mayo Clinic Scottsdale, a neurologist and headache researcher, Dr. David Dodick. Our topic is migraine. If time allows, we'll talk about other migraines. I should also mention that Dr. Dodick is president-elect of the American Headache Society. Feel free to email your questions and comments to line1@aprn.org. You can give us a call at 550-8422, and our outside toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. Please remember, if you're listening to Line 1 after 8 o'clock local time, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we will not be able to answer your questions at that time. I'm going to take, we've got a couple of emails and phone calls, but I'm going to take a little editorial prerogative here and try to see if there's more of an analogy that's useful between asthma and migraines to help our listeners understand this. I describe asthma to patients as an underlying hypersensitivity due to, you know, increased inflammation of the mucous membranes of the lung, where instead of pain, they constrict, and instead of a scab which forms on the skin, they make mucus, and so you get variable amounts of cough and wheeze and shortness of breath. And I almost hear you saying the same thing about the current thoughts about migraine, is that it's hereditary and there's something that seems to lower the threshold to a number of things that trigger it, estrogen just being one.
You are right on. You're spot on. We often refer to, you know, when I'm explaining migraine to patients, we explain it as a hypersensitivity. There's a hypersensitivity of certain brain networks. So you're spot on with that analogy.
All right. So that would explain why exercise or certain smells may aggravate what's going on or to trigger a migraine. There's something that's kind of lowered that threshold genetically or something else we just don't quite understand yet.
Exactly.
Is exercise a common trigger?
Exercise can be a common trigger. It's not one of the most common triggers, but in some patients, it's a very reproducible trigger so that whenever they exercise, they get a migraine. Exertional migraine is well recognized. I was recently reading a study just this morning, actually, that was submitted to a journal that I edit, and they did a controlled study where the people who exercised actually did better. So some people actually get better with exercise, but exercise for some people is a very reproducible trigger. And they have to be managed, obviously a little bit differently, depending on what your trigger is. Sometimes the most common trigger is stress. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, a lot of people, because of that, think that they have stress headaches, or their physician diagnoses them with tension headache because, you know, they're under stress and, you know, you have to get a hold of yourself. But stress, like asthma, mm-hmm. it can be a trigger for asthma, and sure. it can be a trigger for migraine. It's just a trigger. It's not the cause.
Mm-hmm. But with asthma, we've stumbled on, we've discovered that an inhaled corticosteroid taken on a regular basis may dramatically decrease symptoms, not cure, but decrease and control things. Are we at that same point with migraine? We haven't talked about specific treatments. I want to make sure we get there, but can we carry that analogy to that point as well?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain what we call prophylactic medications or preventative medications that people take on a regular basis, on a daily basis, that can dramatically reduce the frequency of migraine. They're not perfect. For some patients, they're a home run. For others, you know, they're a stand-up double, and they help significantly. And for others, they don't work at all because every individual is different. It's not the drug you use, but, of course, the body into which you put that drug. So every individual is different, so the response is going to be different. But there are medications, and plenty of them, that can be quite effective in managing the symptoms and preventing attacks from occurring.
Okay. Have another email. This is from a listener who says, is ocular migraine, in parentheses, painless migraine, that some people say they experience come with increased risk of stroke? That's one question. And the second, are there genetic tests that predetermine whether or not someone is likely to get migraine?
Yeah, so those are two good questions. So what the first question, ocular migraine, we call it migraine aura without headache. Because essentially, it's exactly what migraineurs who have headache experience prior to their headache. But it's particularly more common as people age; they start to get aura without headache at all. It's the same underlying biology as to what's happening in the brain, and they too appear to be at a slightly increased risk of stroke. It isn't the headache that's so important; it's the aura, and likely people don't have a stroke during the aura. I don't want people to get that perception, but actually having aura increases by mechanisms which are not quite clear stroke that occurs outside of a migraine attack. So the answer to the first question is yes. Answer to the second question, are there genetic tests that can be done? There are three genes and genetic tests that are available for a certain type of migraine called hemiplegic migraine, where people actually develop paralysis on one side of the body during their migraine attack. And right now, there's a lot of research going on in the United States and around the world, in fact, on finding other genes that may increase the susceptibility. And a number of genes have been identified, but none yet that are sort of commercially available that really indicate that you're definitely going to develop the disease. It's what we call a susceptibility gene. In other words, having this particular gene mutated increases your susceptibility, but doesn't guarantee that you're going to get the disease. It's like asthma and like diabetes mm-hmm. and like other mm-hmm. complex disorders where mm-hmm. it's likely multiple susceptibility genes that are inherited that give rise to that susceptibility. So the answer to the second question is no, unless you have hemiplegic migraine, there are no commercially available genetic tests that can be done.
The other comment that might be made about genes is genes have products. They have something downstream, and it by discovering the genetic component or association, it sometimes may lead to a better understanding of exactly what the cause of migraine may be. So that's why some interest in it, I'm guessing?
Absolutely, absolutely. The more we can understand fundamentally what's going on a genetic level, as you say, every gene has a product, and if we can understand what that product is and what that product does, we'll understand the biology better, and we'll understand how to intervene better.
Okay. I'm going to take a phone call. Caesar, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, thanks for taking my phone call. I have a 10-year-old son, and 1 year ago, he had his first migraine, which I believe is a migraine because I used to suffer. I'm 33 years old, And for the past 10 years, I haven't had a single migraine. I don't know how that happened, but thank God for that. But anyway, my son had a terrible migraine after playing a couple hours of video game. He was at the point where he was drooling, and he was so confused that couldn't even talk. And it freaked me out. We didn't know what was it. I thought he probably hit his head, because I never saw that happening to somebody that suffers from migraines. Now his migraines are becoming more often. Actually, 2 weeks ago, he had a couple migraines. And he gets to the point that he vomits. He gets very sensitive to light, any type of light. We need to put covers on the windows so he won't be bothered. And it lasts for hours. So I'm a little concerned, because they're becoming more often and more severe. So my question will be, should I take him to a specialist, get him on treatment, or what can I do to help him?
Okay. Cesar, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you to take your answer offline, unless Dr. Dodick has a question of you, and then, because this will lead us right into treatment and what the options are. Is that okay with you, Dr. Dodick?
Yeah, I just have two questions for Cesar. Yeah,
okay.
Cesar, how long has he been having attacks, number one? And number two, does he get confused with every attack?
Actually, he started probably right before turning 9. He turned 10 last December. And actually, that was one of the most severe attacks he had, when he was confused and drooling. But he told me before that one day at school he had a migraine, and he was having double vision.
Mm-hmm.
He was suffering from double vision, and then right after that he will start getting the headache. So it's been, I will say, for the past year, he's been suffering those migraines. And I noticed that when he does computer work at school, or he watch TV for an extended period of time, then he gets migraines.
Okay.
So I'm trying to help him to prevent it, watching the time he spends on TV or on the computer. But yeah, he doesn't get confused all the time.
Okay.
But every episode, I will say it's different. Some more severe than others. But they're definitely severe, to the point that he needs to miss his school, and he will vomit, and definitely just be on bed.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Okay.
I think this is a great point to lead into treatment and prevention and so forth. So, Cesar, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you, sir.
All right. What can you do to help this guy?
Well, you know, visually triggered migraine, very common, especially in people who have individuals who have migraine with aura, because it's the occipital cortex that's usually hypersensitive or hyperexcitable. And what happens is that we get this wave of activity that spreads through our brain, which usually accounts for the visual symptoms. And depending on what lobe of the brain they extend into, patients can stop talking, get confused, start getting tingling on one side of the body. Their face may droop. They may become paralyzed on one side of their body. It sounds like Caesar's son has migraine with aura, and he has what is described as acute confusional migraine, where it's more common in children and adolescents, where they get confused, and it's an aura symptom, but they get very confused, disoriented, unaware of their surroundings, may not even remember people's names, may not even recognize people. I would definitely have him checked out by a specialist. Sometimes it's a sort of a precursor for these hemiplegic migraine episodes that I was talking about, so there may even be a genetic test for this young man. But I would definitely see a specialist, not so much for the genetic tests, but just to make sure there's nothing else going on. And given the fact that it's been happening in an episodic fashion over the past year, it sounds like this is typical acute confusional migraine. But he's going to probably need, for a period of time, preventative therapy. In other words, a medication that this young boy could take on a daily basis for at least 6 months to try to suppress these attacks from happening, because they sound like they're quite disabling when they mm-hmm. occur.
Okay.
And there's also effective treatment. So when the young boy experiences the first symptoms or the first sign that an attack is beginning, rather than let it progress, you treat it with certain medications at the time. So in this young boy, I would think that preventative treatment to try to suppress or reduce the frequency of attacks is definitely in order. And effective treatment for if one attack happens to break through, you treat it before it has a chance to progress.
Let's talk about specific treatment options. And actually, let me say this. I want to make sure Caesar gets some response today. Caesar, if you're listening, my office phone number is 777-1800, 1-800-777. If you call, I'll give you some names of specialists to see locally. Now, let's talk about specifics. What do you do as soon as you're starting to have a headache? You may have identified already certain triggers. You want to avoid those, but now you've got one started. What are the options that are shown to be effective? How effective are they?
Well, you know, the standard of care and the treatment of choice, even in adolescents now, are triptan medications.
Okay.
They're called triptans. They go by a variety of different names. Imitrex and Zolmig and Maxalt and Relpax and Emerge and Frova. These are probably the most effective medications we have for migraine, especially when they're taken early on. So if you have 100 patients who take any individual triptan, it doesn't really matter which one, but any of them, and they take them early on when they recognize the first sign of an attack, 70 to 80% of patients will get fairly quick relief. And it will prevent the attack from progressing. Those are, you know, other medications that can be used, you know, an anti-inflammatory medication, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like Motrin, ibuprofen, Advil, those sorts of things mm-hmm. can be used as well. But the triptans, particularly in a young boy like this who really is quite disabled, I think a triptan would probably be the best medication for him, along with an anti-emetic medication or an anti-nausea medication. Because we know that in patients with migraine, their gastric motility is impaired, not only during an attack, but even in between attacks. And it's so variable, the absorption of these medications, which is why patients sometimes say, you know, this pill works 70% of the time, but doesn't work the other 30%. So you've got to ask yourself, well, why would that be?
Mm-hmm.
If it works, it should work all the time. Well, it works if it gets absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
And some remarkable studies have been done showing that depending on where that pill plops into the stomach, if it plops into the pyloric region and gets emptied quickly into the small intestine, it's absorbed rapidly and works. If it plops into the fundus or in the first part of the stomach and doesn't actually get into the small intestine or is delayed in getting there, it doesn't get absorbed very rapidly. So absorption is key, and when you take the medication is key. So taking it early, taking it with an anti-nausea medication, I think is the best thing for him. And then for prophylactic therapy, we really use by and large the same medications in children that we use in adults, although we modify the dosage. And the medications that are at least FDA approved in the United States for the treatment, for the prophylactic treatment of migraine, are topiramate, divalproic sodium, propranolol, and timolol. Propranolol and timolol are beta blockers, which obviously can't be used in patients with asthma, but those are the four medications in the U.S. that are FDA approved. They're not the only medications that are effective, but they're the only medications that are approved. There are other medications that are effective. In children, I use ciproheptadine, a drug that also goes by the name of periactin, and the tricyclic antidepressants are sometimes effective in children, so drugs like amitriptyline and nortriptyline can also be effective. Sometimes in these kids with, and even adults with acute confusional migraine or migraine with aura, calcium channel blockers can also be effective. So there's a variety of different options that can be employed for prophylactic treatment and for acute treatment. And finally, I'll end by saying that there are some non-prescription remedies for migraine that I actually use. I don't see a lot of children, but I do see children and adolescents from time to time. And what I sometimes will start with is just some supplements. So there are supplements that have been shown to be effective for the prevention of migraine, like a vitamin B2, coenzyme Q10, magnesium, and something that's called butterbur, which is a plant extract.
also goes by the name of pedicites. And there are some commercially available supplements that combine all of those ingredients at the appropriate dosages into one tablet. So starting with something non-prescription or adding something non-prescription to a prescription preventative medication can really give that prescription a boost and have a, what we call an adjunctive effect.
When you mentioned the vitamins and minerals, I can't help but ask about any known association between vitamin D deficiency, since that's such a hot topic now.
And migraine, no, not as of yet. No literature on that.
And one other comment, and then we'll take some more emails. When you mentioned the GI, the gastrointestinal disturbance, the slowing down of motility, perhaps affecting the absorption of medications given orally, many of the triptans are given both as an oral preparation, as a nasal spray, and sometimes even as an injection. Do you have a preference for that, for any reason, for how you might give these?
Absolutely. So if inconsistency or if a patient vomits or gets nauseated early, if that's a problem, then I go immediately to a nasal spray or to an injection. Beware that the melt tablets, the tablets that go under the tongue, a lot of people think that they're absorbed through the buccal mucosa in the mouth. They're not. They actually get dissolved with the saliva. You swallow it, and it's absorbed in the gut. That's one thing to be aware of. But the nasal spray, again, be aware that most of the nasal sprays are actually absorbed through the gut because you end up swallowing it and it's absorbed in the small intestine. But at least some of the nasal sprays, half of it gets absorbed through the nasal mucosa and gets into the bloodstream very quickly, so absorption is not as much of an issue. So the nasal spray is definitely one way to go in patients who are really nauseated. But the injection, that's why the injectable triptans work so well and work so consistently, because there's no issue with absorption. There is soon to come out an inhaler, a new medication, probably will be FDA approved this year, where it's like a puffer. And the absorption of that looks like giving it IV. So it gets in through the lungs and it gets in very quickly. There's going to be a new triptan coming out in the form of a patch and a triptan coming out in the form of a needleless injection that's really thrust by a nitrogen gas. So there's actually no needle, but it's put on the skin like you're going to give a needle, and you flip a switch, but there's actually no needle. So there are going to be other strategies whereby we can get medication in quickly without giving a needle, particularly to children and adolescents, because they just do not like needles. Mm-hmm. Who does? But they especially don't like it.
Right. Okay, so the bottom line is that there are very effective treatments for 70-80% of people if we start medications quickly enough, primarily the triptans, and often more effective if we don't go orally. That's kind of the bottom line I heard, and that there are also, for those frequently having problems, several choices for prophylaxis of prevention, although the downside is you have to take those regularly.
Correct.
Okay. All right. I have a number of emails, a number of phone calls. There's no ways we're going to get to all of them. I'm going to have to pick and choose what seem most helpful to the program. An email: how effective are alternative treatments such as for treating migraines, for example, yoga, massage, trigger point therapy?
Good question. I think some of these alternatives can be very effective for selected patients. So things like biofeedback, relaxation therapy, yoga, meditation, acupuncture, all of these things I've seen be effective in selected patients. Not everybody finds them effective, but some do. And certainly for those patients who can't tolerate taking medications or simply don't want to take medications, those are alternative paths that can be pursued. There's not a lot of evidence to support all of those. In fact, when you look under some of the guidelines for migraine, you won't see some of these things. But nevertheless, there are, as long as, you know, my approach is that as long as it doesn't hurt the patient, or you know, expose them to a risk, then if a patient finds acupuncture or meditation or yoga to be helpful, then I say, you know, I'm all in favor of it because it's a sort of relaxation therapy.
Okay, Jim, you're on line one.
Hi, I wanted to ask a question, seeing if your guest had heard anything about a connection between aspartame and severe migraines. I had recently watched a documentary, I can't recall the name, in which they were saying there's a large connection between severe migraines and consumption of aspartame and, you know, Crystalite and NutraSweet and soft drinks and gum and that sort. And I wanted to know if you could comment on that or if you have heard of that at all. And I'll take my question off there.
All right, thanks for your call.
Yeah, I sure have. Definitely there's a link between aspartame and migraine. It's been published a number of times. And that includes NutraSweet and all these other artificial sweeteners. So for patients that are having frequent attacks, you sort of have to simplify their diet and make sure they're not drinking soda, especially soda that contains caffeine or soda that contains aspartame or anything that contains aspartame for that matter. And the other very prominent dietary trigger is caffeine. Now, while some people feel that, you know, give me a cup of coffee and a couple Advil and I'll feel great, and really a lot of the medications that are out there off the shelf contain caffeine, caffeine can definitely cause rebound. So while it helps going in, it really hurts coming out. So caffeine is a big one, too. So I eliminate caffeine in a lot of my migraine sufferers who are having really frequent headaches. That leads me to maybe just one editorial point on diet. There are a lot of migraine diets out there. And one of the problems is that not everybody is sensitive to dietary triggers. Some are, some aren't. And the dietary triggers from one individual to another varies considerably. So there may be one patient who can't eat onions and nuts. There may be another patient who can't drink red wine or chocolate. And somebody else is allergic to bananas and salads. And so to get a diet that's, you know, individualized to a particular person, very difficult. But there's been a recent study that hasn't even been published yet, so I'm giving you sort of a glimpse into the study, where they actually looked at the formation of antibodies to foods. They looked at 266 different foods, and they tested a number of patients, their blood, and to see who develops antibodies to these 266 different foods. And what they did was they basically split the group up into one group when they put them on a provocative diet, where it contained all of the foods to which they had antibodies. And in the other group, they put them on an elimination diet, where they eliminated only those foods that they had antibodies to, and found dramatic difference in the people they put on the elimination diet compared to the provocative diet. Now, the problem is that the individuals in the study, they would never know the foods to which they had antibodies. It isn't that simple where I eat something that I have an antibody to and I develop an attack. But knowing that makes me think that coming soon will probably be commercially available kits where you can actually do this in a scientifically rigorous way where you test people to foods to which they have an allergy and eliminate just those foods in their diet to try to make a difference in migraine. This has been shown, too, by the way, in irritable bowel syndrome and in other disorders. So I don't poo-poo diet anymore like I used to. I think there's something to it. You know, even for people who don't think they have dietary triggers, if they form antibodies to certain foods, it's going to make sense to eliminate those. But we're not quite there yet.
Are you talking about IgE antibodies or IgG antibodies?
IgG, type 1, 2, and 3, ironically. Okay. And those are the antibodies that, of course, produce an inflammatory cascade.
Okay. Sandra, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, thank you. I wanted to ask about rebound headaches from taking Imitrex and Maxalt. Years ago, I had a lot of migraine headaches, and I was given those medications, not at the same time, obviously, and told, as the doctor just said, to take them when you start to get a headache. And apparently, I got too much and started getting rebound headaches, or at least that was what I was told. And so a neurologist helped sort of wean me off of them. And then I went for a long period with no headaches, and recently I've been getting occasional ones again. Can you comment on that at all?
All right. We'll take, if you don't mind taking your call off the air, we have about 2 minutes left.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad that somebody asked that question, because really we don't recommend these triptans being taken any more than twice per week, because they definitely can cause rebound. And by rebound, I mean that the medication themselves, even though they work when you take it, they ensure that you're going to get another attack.
In fact, we're doing research right now where we're giving animals triptans. We expose them to a triptan for a week. And then 4 weeks later, we sort of test the animal. And these animals are hypersensitive. They're hypersensitive to triggers like environmental stress, light, and they start displaying pain behavior. And so what we've come to recognize is that triptans in some people can produce long-lasting changes in the nervous system that render them more susceptible to more attacks. They lower the threshold, so to speak. And some people can really get themselves into a problem in a real hurry by taking a triptan, gets rid of the pain, pain comes back, they take another one, they take another one, and before you know it, they're taking them almost every day. So, you know, if you're one of those people who recognized, who has had that problem before, you're going to have to be very careful, and a triptans may not be the right answer for you, but because they can lead to rebound in a significant proportion of patients.
Another email, perhaps we can get done real quickly, says, is there a correlation between migraine and Hughes syndrome, H-U-G-H-E-S?
I'm not aware of one.
Yeah, I'm not sure what Hughes syndrome is. I just thought I would ask. Figured I didn't know. All right. Well, let's end by just in the last minute giving us your overview, the things you want us to remember as we leave here. What are the most important messages?
Well, the important message for patients is to seek help. And demand to be cared for, because migraine is more than just a headache, and a lot of migraineurs are still to this day not taken seriously by coworkers, by family members, and worst of all, by physicians. So seek help, because there's tremendous amount that we can do, and research is propelling this field faster than ever, and I have no doubt that in the next 10 years, we will understand much better the genetic basis for this disorder, and we will have very specific treatments that are more specific for this disorder and therefore much better tolerated. But, you know, it's more than a headache. It's a neurological disorder. There are treatments available. Make sure if you have aura that and you have other vascular risk factors that you make sure that they're managed so that you minimize your risk of any negative consequences like stroke.
Thank you very much for the time. Very educational hour. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
For those who are listening, remember we return next week with Marshall Miller and Melissa Lopez, and we'll discuss the sexuality concerns and questions of college students. I also want to remind Caesar, if he's still listening, you can call my office, 777-1800, and we'll make a referral for you and your son. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Dave Waldron graciously engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.